And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flames are enfolded into the crown knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one. This is Pints with Jack, Season 7, Episode 23, Jack's Bookshelf, Julian of Norwich, After Hours with Dr. Grace Hammond. Hello everyone, here on Pints with Jack we are reading our way to the works of C.S. Lewis, but this month we're snooping through Jack's bookshelf, looking at the authors and books which shaped the life and writing of C.S. Lewis. And today we're turning to look at our first female writer, Lady Julian of Norwich, which is why in the opening of this episode I quoted T.S. Eliot, where he incorporates Lady Julian's famous saying that all manner of things shall be well into the poem Little Gidding. And to introduce us to Lady Julian, today I'm joined by Dr. Grace Hammond. Dr. Grace Hammond is a writer, speaker, and scholar with a passion for sharing the beauty and truth found in old books. Grace has a doctorate in English, specializing in medieval literature and theology from Duke University. Grace has written for several publications, including Plough Quarterly, Mere Orthodoxy, Dapple Things, Fathom, as well as academic journals and collections. She has a podcast on old literature, theology, and their relevance to our lives today called Old Books with Grace. And she recently published Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, where she meditates upon the medieval representations of Jesus in theology and literature, including those from our focus today, Lady Julian of Norwich. Grace Hammond, welcome to Pints with Jack.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad we were finally able to connect because I've been a long-time listener.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I do want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about our first female author on Jack's bookshelf. It has been guys all the way up until now.
I'm so pleased. I take every chance I get. If anyone wants me to talk about Julian of Norwich, I am here for it 100%.
Well, today I'm enjoying a West Coast IPA from Best Day Brewing. Are you drinking anything?
I am drinking a very fancy drink called the Kirkland Signature Sparkling Water in lime flavor.
Sounds lovely. Cheers.
Cheers.
So a lot of the questions that I ask on these Jack's Bookshelf episodes are all very similar. And so very often all I really have to do is just change the name of the person I'm asking. But obviously in this case, I had to change all of the him to hers and the man to the woman. So would you mind just introducing her to us? Who was Lady Julian of Norwich? And more importantly, why does she have a boy's name?
All right, well, here, let's just set heads spinning right away and acknowledge that we're not even sure if Julian is her real name. It may not have been the name that she was born with. Yes. This is because Julian of Norwich was an anchorite in medieval England, and anchorites often took the name of the church in which they lived in. So take a sec to say what a medieval anchorite is, because that might be a new word to some folks. Anchorites were men and women, but mostly women, who would basically take a vow of death to the outer world, and they would live in a cell, often bricked in, walled in. It would have a door because people could come and go, but not the anchorite. The anchorite stayed put in that church. There was a window into the main part of the church where they could participate in the liturgy and be a part of church life, but they stayed there and they had a ministry of prayer and of place and of contemplation and, in Julian's case, of writing. And so she had had this wild experience before she became an anchorite in May of 1373, where she thought she was dying. She thought she was on her deathbed. And instead of dying, in this night in May, she had a series of what she called showings, which were sights and sounds from God. And basically, she, you know, spoiler, didn't die. And she spent the rest of her life meditating and thinking about and writing about this experience and what the Lord had showed her, and then praying about it, thinking about it more, revising it. And so this was her life's work, was the production of what we now call Revelations of Divine Love. That's an editorial title. Most medieval books didn't have titles. And so that's one that folks decided was good and slapped on there. And this work was her life's work after this experience of her near death in her at age 30.
Mm-hmm. Why do we not know whether or not Julian was her name?
We have no record of her other than her own writing, before her taking her anchoritic vows. So we don't know what her name was, and we don't know really very much about her life at all, other than what she tells us and then what we know coming from some wills that were bequeathing money to help maintain her in the church and to ask her for her prayers. And we know a little bit from another medieval mystical writer named Marjorie Kemp, who visited her in Norwich and left a record of that encounter. And that's really our sources for her life. So she doesn't say, you know, this is my name and this is my experience. She's just writing as Julian of Norwich, at coming from this church of St. Julian's in Conisford, Norwich. So it's a mystery lost to time.
And what makes her such an important author?
On a sort of basic level, she's the first woman writer that we know of in English, which that alone is a very big deal, to have this woman's voice coming to us from this time, and she's writing this herself. You know, we receive it from her. She's not confessing it to a spiritual advisor, even like a lot of women's writings of the time are. So she's a fairly unique and early women's voice. So that's one thing. But then another thing is that she has written this beautifully profound theology of the love of God. And it is written astoundingly beautiful. Her style itself, I mean, I come to Julian via an English department. My background is not in theology. I've now read a lot of it, but my background is in English literature. And that's how I first encountered her, because she has such beautiful, magnificent prose. Mm. But even more so, she writes this lovely, beautiful theology that is extremely powerful, both participates in traditions of her own age. She's a woman of her time, but it also transcends them in a lot of ways. So it makes for a very interesting reading experience. And time after time, folks who read her walk away and think, wow, I have learned a lot and now I have a lot to think about. Mm. That's a primary experience of reading her that C.S. Lewis had too.
Did it make a splash when it was first made available?
So Julian was writing in a fairly complicated environment. She first had her experience in 1373 and then wrote a lot of it down pretty close to that experience happening. We don't have exact dates, but pretty close to it. She didn't write all of it down because she wasn't sure what she thought about a lot of it. She was very careful. She has this reputation for being almost radical, but that's not a fair assessment. This is a very careful writer, a very thoughtful writer, and thoughtful theologian. And so she holds back some of it, and then over the course of decades, thinks on it, rewrites it, and has this long text. So you call the early one the short text, and the later one the long text. And so the long text is what she writes, where she has way more of her ideas thought out. She includes things that she didn't include in the earlier text. And this is partially because Julian's writing in a fraught time to write in English about theological matters. It's not like you're immediately going to get burned at the stake or anything like that. But the authorities are recovering from the shock to the system that the theologian Wycliffe, he'd done some interesting damage at Oxford. He was really encouraging people to read the Bible in English. He was confronting a lot of traditional hierarchical church structures. And so they were really suspicious at that time of theology written in English. So theology written in English by a woman was going to be even more suspicious. So her work had some circulation, but not the wide circulation that you see from some of her contemporaries, like Walter Hilton has a much wider circulation. And he was another English mystical writer from a little bit before Julian's own era. So you see, there was some trepidation, some hesitation around wide circulation of this manuscript.
Mm-hmm. And when did you yourself come across her, and what about it got you hooked?
I had not encountered her until I was in my doctoral program. I'd heard her name before, but I took this class and read her alongside another medieval writer of her same era named William Langland, who wrote the poem Piers Plowman. And she just seemed to me suffused with the love of God. And it was so beautiful and so refreshing. And it was a strange experience too, because like so much of medieval writers, but especially for her, you get a glimpse into who she is as a person, but you know so little about her, which for us modern readers is always an interesting experience, because we associate so much of our reading of a person with their biography, right? With their life and their, you know, what's going on in their life. So it's kind of a strange experience to read the words that are coming so vivid from so far back in the past in such a beautiful mode of writing, and yet you know so little about them. And so I was struck by her immediately, and I had never heard some of the things she talked about before in the way that she talked about them. So she writes, for instance, of Christ as a mother, and drawing upon highly scriptural sources. She's not pulling these things out of thin air, but she's thinking about the ways that Christ's love is talked about in scripture as compassionate, like the mother hen drawing chicks under his wing. And she expands on that to think about what the love of Christ looks like in our individual lives if he truly loves us as uniquely and preciously as a mother loves her own precious child. And so just images like that that are both shocking in that, you know, you don't come across that image on a regular basis, though it has these scriptural roots, but also very approachable. Everybody knows what mothers are. Everyone has had one. There's a universal experience there that changes person to person, but there's a common well. And that's how her writing works a lot. She takes these images that everybody has seen before, that you know, and then she just goes deeper in bit by bit and unfolds what kinds of beautiful and sacred things are there for us.
Now, with other people in Jack's bookshelf, they're very often literary folks. They've written a number of books, commenting and interacting with other works of the time. But it's a little different for Lady Julian, given the fact that this was a revelation and she's in many ways a unique voice. And as you mentioned, the first female author in English. Can we even guess at what other books or authors perhaps shaped her?
Well, there's kind of a raging debate over how literate.
Oh, I like that.
Julian was. So she says herself that she's not literate. What she likely means is that she can't read Latin, that she can read English and seems that she can write English, but is not Latin or traditionally educated in Latin. There's debate over that, but that seems to be sort of what people lean towards. That being said, Norwich at the time was a very bustling city in England. It was a huge center for trade, and there were many monasteries there, and some with very good libraries. So Julian certainly could have had access to some authors, and she certainly seems to be reacting and writing alongside some current religious movements of the time. So for instance, a very, very popular mystical writer who came shortly before her was this guy named Richard Rolla, and he was a hermit. And he wrote all of these books about one's emotional response to the love of God and the feelings that you get in response to God's love and kind of the rapture of contemplation. And so at points in her work, you can see her wrestling with, look, it's okay if you are suffering and are not having these beautiful feelings of rapture as you contemplate God. Sometimes you're going to feel really distant and far away from God. That does not actually mean anything about how close God is to you, who is closer than your very skin. His intimacy is beyond anything we can imagine. And so I think you see her writing against some of these things that too closely associate emotional response to the love of God. And then another thing that I suspect myself, I would just be shocked if she had not read Augustine's Confessions in some form. Mm. There's no proof of that whatsoever, and there's no way of proving that. But she's dealing with a lot of Augustinian ideas, like the idea of evil as only a lack.
Yeah.
So evil as the absence of good, which is one of Augustine's huge theological ideas that he writes about at length. And I think she must have come across that and thought about it a lot in this Augustinian connection somehow. And I think some of her reflections feel like reflections in the Confessions, but there's no way of knowing. So
that does make sense. I mean, it was a wildly popular book, and you know, it was the first autobiography. You don't see in ancient literature quite that same first person reflective view, much outside of the maybe perhaps the Stoics, and they're all just saying everything you feel is wrong.
Exactly. And Augustine, you know, everyone, all of these medieval writers quoted him all the time. So he was kind of in the water. So that's why it's hard to say whether she had read him or just encountered him through her spiritual advisors or her priest or friends or whoever. We don't know, but I feel like she's read him in my heart of hearts.
Well, would you mind just giving us a sketch of her work? If somebody were picking it up, what would they expect to find?
So when you pick up Julian of Norwich's writings, you're going to pick up more than likely a translation. She was writing in Middle English, which is the age of Chaucer. Actually, her and Chaucer were probably born in the same year. So they were exact contemporaries. He wrote the Canterbury Tales. So she's writing in Middle English. So if you pick up not a translation, you're going to see a language that looks really similar to ours in some ways, but the spelling is totally out of control and the sentence structure is really different. And there's some different vocabulary words, but Middle English is super fun. So if you ever want to give it a shot, it's hard work, but it's fun. And I highly recommend it. But if you're picking up a translation and just looking at content, first, you're going to meet some very strange prayer requests where she talks about wanting to really be wounded by the love of God. And she talks about these wounds of compassion and contrition. And she also talks about wanting a bodily sickness, which is very strange to us. We really don't relate to this kind of prayer request in modernity. And she wants to actually be present at the crucifixion. And this was a common medieval theme, and that later developed into really popular Ignatian ideas, right? Of imagining yourself at the foot of the cross and what's going on, what's happening. You're really there, really actually present, watching Christ's body, watching the blood, watching Mary, the mother, weeping, you know, all that stuff. So this is what Julian wants. And then we're plunged into her experience of the deathbed. And she goes through showing by showing what she sees and what's happening. And it starts off by she thinks she's dying, and the priest is, priests are present at deathbeds. He's holding a crucifix before her face as comfort and as a reminder that Christ has died for you. Suffer bravely, you're suffering with God. Heaven is close. So she's looking at the crucifix and it starts bleeding, actively bleeding. And that's when she plunges into this wild contemplative experience. And the rest of the book is a description of that. And a lot of it too is her reflection later. So a lot of it, and this makes it really interesting for a piece of medieval literature, she'll say, I saw this, but it was confusing to me. And this is what I thought later. Now I'm thinking that it meant this. So you see a lot of her actual theological process and her prayerful process of figuring out what things mean, which is very unusual in a medieval book. So that's kind of the dip your toe in the water, getting into Julian's revelations.
Sure. And in what ways did Julian influence C.S. Lewis?
Well, C.S. Lewis, he has some really interesting responses to Julian. She appears multiple times in letters to his brother and to his friends and to some of his former students. He was reading her for the first time, I believe, in 1940, which is kind of funny to see how some of these letters, he's encountering her for the first time. And he's, as most of us are, when we read Julian for the first time, kind of taken aback by it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what do I do with this? He writes to Bede Griffiths, who is one of his earlier pupils, that it was a dangerous book, and I'm glad I didn't read it much earlier. But at the same time, he is very struck by many of the themes in it, especially the theme, which is very strong and remarkable for a medieval book. Medieval books are usually pretty into contemptus mundi, pretty into hating the world, you know, reject the world like it's a bad place. And Julian does not do that, but she writes a lot about the littleness of the universe. The universe is tiny. God holds it in his hand. She describes it like a hazelnut in its size, and it could fall to pieces for its littleness. And Lewis loved that idea that, no, it's not that the world is a horrid, evil, bad place. You know, he writes that's Manichaeism. That's bad. That's not a true thing. But its littleness, its frailty, its both precious but tiny and frail. That's straight from Julian, and he loves that idea and writes about it in several of his books. So that's one major theme that he really took from her and enjoyed a lot.
Yeah, I've got one of the letters to his brother here. He says, I have been reading this week the revelations of Mother Julian of Norwich, 14th century. Not always so profitable as I had expected, but well worth reading. This is a curious vision. And then he quotes this. Also, he showed me a little thing, the bigness of a hazelnut in my hand. I thought, what may this be? And it was answered, it is all that is made. I marveled how it might last, but for me thought it might suddenly have fallen to naught for littleness. And then Lewis comments on this saying, now that is a good turn given to the monkish, or indeed Christian, view of the whole created universe. For to say that it is bad, as some are inclined to do, is blasphemous and Manichaean. But to say that it is small, that seems just right. And then he goes on, I'd like your comments on this bit, please. He says, very odd too is her doctrine of, quote, the grand deed. Mm. Christ tells her again and again, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. She asks how it can be well since some are damned. He replied that all that is true, but the secret grand deed will make even that very well. With you, this is impossible, but not with me.
Yes. He quotes that all shall be well at several places. He quotes it in The Great Divorce, but elsewhere mm-hmm. as well. So this was a significant and strange thing that he was chewing over. But this part of Julian's visions are honestly some of the most dense and difficult pieces of reading her. So the whole of that very famous quote that T.S. Eliot uses in that quote with which you began in Little Gidding, it's actually a very strange sentence when taken in whole. And the sentence is, sin is behoovely, but all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. And so what Julian's wrestling with, let me just first say, behoovely is a Middle English word that we don't have anymore. And sometimes it's translated as necessary. Sometimes it's translated as unavoidable. Sometimes it's translated as inevitable. And sometimes it's translated as befitting. So it's this very strange, difficult to translate concept that relates to a Latin idea that is about befittingness, basically, I think is probably the closest. God is telling Julian, look, you don't see the place right now of everything that seems really horrible, but in my plan, everything is being enveloped in the arms of love. There is nothing that is unredeemable, that is beyond me. And so he then shows her this vision that didn't appear in the short text because she didn't know what to do with it. For close to 30 years, she was wrestling with this grand secret deed of God. And it's actually a sort of revision, not a revision in like a rewriting over, but a imagination an imaginative telling of the fall that Julian sees, and it's called The Lord and the Servant. And that's what this All Shall Be Well promise is referring to. And it's sort of a double overlaid vision of the fall of Adam and the incarnation of Christ, and how all of this is so much bigger than we can understand. And it, and a lot of it is about, which this always makes things confusing. A lot of it is about time. And anytime you bring in time into like an equation and time and eternity, you're going to kind of be like, my head is spinning. I don't know what to do. So she's thinking about the collapse of time and how for God, the fall of Adam and all of its horrors, which are very real. She doesn't deny the reality of the fallout of this, and the incarnation of Christ are simultaneous. And so what does that mean? And that's what she's meditating on. And yeah, it is it's a pretty heady piece of this. And yet it's also challenging and encouraging for thinking about how we confine God by our own sin, and how Julian's saying that's not how that works. That's in your response. And God cannot actually be confined by your sin. It remains mysterious. So
well, that definitely seemed to be Lewis's take on it, at least in the letter that I'm looking at, because he says, my mood changes about this. Sometimes it seems mere drivel. And then he goes on to say, but other times it has the unanswerable, illogical convincingness of things heard in a dream and appeals to what is one of my deepest convictions, vis-a-vis that reality always escapes prediction by taking a line which was simply not in your thought at all. And he goes on and talks a little bit more and says, at any rate, this book excites me.
That's right. It reads dreamlike, that whole sequence does. And you understand why she didn't include it in the original, because she was thinking and praying about it for a very long time. And it's sort of at the heart of these revelations. And it's at the heart of reading it. As a reader, you're really asked to reckon with this. And it is exciting. Lewis is right. But it is also confusing, and it is always really interesting to teach it. People get really reactive to it in different ways, and that's how you can tell that it's hitting some kind of a weird chord. It's an interesting sequence.
Well, given that, if somebody has never read Julian Norwich before, how would you recommend they begin? Should they just dive into the text? Should they start in a particular place? Should they go and read or watch something else first?
Well, I must say that I'm always a big fan of just going to the text. I think Lewis would back me up here and say, just go read her. I would say that if you have never read her before, don't start with the Middle English, even though, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a huge fan of actually trying to give Middle English a shot, even if you've never tried before. But first, read her in translation. There's a translation that I recommend. It's pretty old now, but it's from the Classics of Western Spirituality series, which has so many wonderful mystical and contemplative writers in translation. And it's by Edmund College and James Walsh. And it's a fairly affordable little copy. And so that's a translation that I like to use. It's trying to hew very closely to Julian's Middle English. And some translations are either more creative or they're more bringing in different things. And that can be really great. But I think for a first reading, hewing as close as you can is a good call. So I recommend just going for it. I recommend reading the long text first. Don't bother with the short text unless you become really obsessed. But the long text is where so many of the wonderful goodies are, and the real treats and joys of her prose. She has clearly matured as a prose writer, which makes it just a joy to read, even outside of the theological gifts that it offers. So go to the long text and just dive in.
Wonderful. Well, I didn't want to end today without setting some time aside to talk about your book, Jesus Through Medieval Eyes. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about it?
I would love to. And I mean, that's another way to dive into Julian too. I reflect a lot on Julian in that book. And so if you're like, I would like to learn more, but I'm not sure if I'm ready to tackle a medieval anchorite at this moment in time, I talk about her there. But in Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, I look at a bunch of art and metaphors and different modes of writing of the Middle Ages and the ways that they presented Christ. So these are a very different, varying set of ideas and imagery. So things that are pretty familiar to us, though we might not think about them that often, like Christ as a judge, Christ as a lover or bridegroom, like in the Song of Songs and in some of his parables, or things that are a little more unconventional to us, like Julian's own Christ as a mother or Christ as a knight. In another text, I mentioned Piers Plowman. And so there's a wide range of really interesting portrayals, and I kind of sit down with them and think with them on what they can teach us today and what they show us about what we believe about Christ in postmodernity.
And that's also available in audiobook, which makes me very, very happy.
It is. I read it myself, which is a very interesting and fun and very strange experience. Yeah, you can get it wherever you get your books. It is published by Zondervan Reflective. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it. It's been a pleasure to share my medieval friends with folks. And C.S. Lewis has a not small effect in the ways that I read. Some of his ways of reading I talk about in the first chapter to that book. So I hope he would have approved as well.
I'm sure I would. Grace Hammond, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real delight.
And as the landlord rings the bell for final drinks, can you please tell us where people can go to find out more about you and listen to your podcast, Old Books with Grace?
Yes, you can find my podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts, on any kind of normal podcasting platform. I have social media, regrettably. I have Instagram at Old Books with Grace, and I have, what are we calling it? Twitter, X, whatever it is, at Grace Hammond, PhD. And I also have a Substack newsletter that comes out once a month on fun medieval and early modern topics. And it's called Medievalish with Grace Hammond. So any of those places.
Wonderful. Well, I'd like to thank our sound engineers, Taylor and Sarah, our intern, Julia. And thanks to all of you for listening, our patron supporters, particularly our top tier supporters, Mary Margaret, Aldo, Alex, James, Matt, Erica, Joelle, Amanda, Thomas, Bud 1, Bud 2, Shane, Kay, Paul, Gary, Stephen, Kelly, Chris, John, James, Kate, Peter, David, Angela, and Rowdy. We pray for you all every week, and particularly offering prayers for all of the requests in our Slack channel. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and try and use the word behoovely in conversation sometime today. And please join us next time when we'll continue going further up
and further in.
Cheers.
Cheers.